From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Two or three million people in the U.S. are living with obsessive-compulsive disorder. More if you add in the 500,000 children and teenagers coping with OCD. Their brains are sending danger warnings about some recurring thoughts, and they try to calm their anxiety by repeating some procedure or ritual. We hear from two therapists. Hannah Breckenridge has been dealing with OCD herself since she was a child. And John Hirschfield, who's written books about it, heads the OCD and Anxiety Center of Greater Baltimore.
Somebody in your life, somebody in your circle right now is debilitated by their OCD. They are trudging through from waking up to going to bed at night, trying to figure out a way to survive with these unwanted intrusive thoughts that make them feel terrible about themselves.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. You've probably heard it. Someone takes an extra few seconds to straighten out a place setting or maneuver into a parking place and then says with a little shrug or a smile, "I'm so OCD." That's not what we're talking about this morning. First, that's not OCD. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is more than keeping things tidy or making sure your hands are clean. And it's not true that we're all a little OCD. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is a mental health disorder. It's not a personality quirk, and it's not optional for people who have it. The anxiety can be crippling. But the good news is that OCD can be treated. This is OCD Awareness Week. This morning, we're going to learn about OCD from two people who know what it's like to live with it and who work to help people with OCD get it under control. Hannah Breckenridge is a social worker and therapist in Lutherville who specializes in treating people with OCD and anxiety. She's a member of the International OCD Foundation and manages the Forum for the Therapists with OCD and Related Disorders Special Interest Group. Welcome to the show, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me.
And John Hirschfield is a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist who directs the OCD and Anxiety Center of Greater Baltimore, where he treats children over age 10 as well as adults. He's written several books, including When a Family Member Has OCD and Everyday Mindfulness for OCD. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah, let me pick up with the myths about OCD. What, in your view, is the most common misconception?
I think one of the most common misconceptions is that OCD is, like you said, a personality quirk. It's something that is insignificant, and in some way, it just doesn't interfere with somebody's life. You know, it's something that, and in some instances, people will think that it actually helps them. You know, people might say, "Oh, my OCD helps me at work, and you know, it helps me get things done." When in fact, OCD is not something that's insignificant. It has a, you know, in order to sort of qualify diagnostically for OCD, it has to have a significant impact on your life, meaning, you know, at work or at school. And it's also something that is not a positive thing. It's generally very distressing for the person who has OCD, and it's not something that is, I guess, something to be brushed off so casually.
So someone who would say, "Oh, my OCD helps me," is someone who has not been diagnosed with OCD.
I can say I have not heard somebody with OCD say that.
John, what do you think the worst misconception is?
I think the worst misconceptions about OCD come from not understanding what the word means. It's all in the title. Obsessive compulsive disorder. If you understand what an obsession is, nobody would casually say, like, "Oh, you know, I'm obsessed with this, I'm obsessed with that." Because an obsession is an unwanted intrusive thought, image, or urge. And it's perceived by the person who's experiencing it extremely distressing. If you think about the kind of unwanted thoughts you have during the day and just imagine them turned up, you know, turn the volume knob all the way up and experiencing them almost like a lucid dream almost. It's the intensity of the unwanted thoughts and images and urges that people with OCD have, I think, is generally underestimated by the general population. And same thing with compulsions. These are behaviors that people are engaging in to try to wrestle down some kind of certainty about their thoughts, that they're not going to come true. And the extent to which they will sacrifice large parts of their life, their relationships, their time, their jobs, to get these compulsions done, that's also incredibly distressing. And then you have this word disorder, which really means out of order, right? We all have unwanted thoughts and we all have rituals that we use to get through the day. But it becomes a disorder when it's taking up more than an hour of your life and when it's really interfering in the quality of your experience of life.
So what are some of the obsessions that show up most in your work?
Of course, you have some of the more well-known obsessions, obsessions surrounding contamination, obsessions around things being just so, being just right.
Like just right arranged correctly?
Mm-hmm. Like that.
Exactly the right typeface in your when you're writing in the computer, exactly the right font being chosen, things like that.
Yes. Go ahead.
I think something important to understand about that particular kind of OCD, I think that's one of the things that people perceive as like, oh, you know, they're just kind of like that. They like the exact right font or something like that.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's just, you know, they're trying to get it to feel right. And it feels right if you have the right font. And if I don't get the right font, then I'm just going to sort of feel uncomfortable for the rest of the day. Sometimes it's connected to a whole other process. If I don't get the right font, maybe my mother will get cancer.
Oh.
Right. This is kind of how the OCD mind can work. It will throw something at you and say, well, how much are you willing to risk to make sure that your mother is safe? I mean, it's just a matter of changing the font or rewriting the sentence or rereading this whole page. Are you not willing to do that to save your poor mother? And this starts to seem like a reasonable negotiation at some point, and then it becomes very unreasonable when you can't stop. I work with a lot of people who have unwanted, intrusive, violent thoughts. These are the least violent people you'll ever meet, but they this constant barrage of horror movies running through their heads.
Violent thoughts. They are afraid they will do something
afraid
violent?
Afraid they'll harm themselves, harm someone else, or be negligently responsible for harming someone else. I also work with a lot of people with unwanted, intrusive sexual thoughts, that they'll do something inappropriate or that they'll wake up one day and be a different orientation than they thought they were. And the extent to which people will try to get certain about these thoughts, that's how you can really tell the disorder.
Do the obsessions generate their own compulsions, or do people with OCD have to sort of strategize? I'm troubled by these thoughts, and what can I do? And do they come up with a compulsion to try to ease the concern about the obsession?
I guess the question is the compulsion, explicitly linked to the obsession, or is it more of a feeling?
Well, and I guess it's also, I'm trying to understand the extent to which someone suffering with this has some control over the compulsion, because they apparently don't have control over the obsession, from what you said.
Right. I really like that question, because it shows how knowing one person with OCD doesn't mean you know more than one person with OCD. I think there's some people with OCD where the thought presents itself as, do this thing or else this bad thing will happen. And then they're having to decide, you know, do I need to do this compulsion or not? But sometimes it is presented the way you just described it, where you have an unwanted thought and it's, okay, well, what can I do to reassure myself that this thought won't come true? Maybe I should Google it and, you know, get some information that way. Or maybe I should ask my friend what they think. Or maybe I should play it over in my head 1,000 times until I figure it out. So there is this process of discovery. And the problem is, when you find something that works, if you have OCD, it's very hard to let go of it. You've now trained your brain that that's the thing you need to do in that situation. You've had the unwanted thought. You found something that made the thought go away temporarily. Now you feel like you always have to do that. And it creates this loop that gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
How widespread is OCD?
I think 2.3% is the lifetime prevalence.
Yeah.
And with children, it's about anywhere between 0.5% and 1%. About 1 in 200 kids at any given point meet the diagnostic criteria.
And it tends to run in families.
Yes.
Which means parents who have OCD may be trying to parent kids who have it too.
That happens pretty frequently in my practice, yeah.
Not an unusual occurrence.
Sometimes the kids will come in and the parents don't know that they have OCD. And that actually happened in my case when I was a kid.
It's not perfectly understood, though. I mean, not, sure. If you could have two parents with OCD, and that doesn't mean that the kid definitely is going to have OCD either.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking about obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, with two Baltimore-area therapists who know it from the inside, John Hirschfeld and Hannah Breckenridge. So, Hannah, how did OCD show up in your life?
When I was about 9 years old, I started having sort of contamination obsessions, so I was very worried that I was going to contract some illness. I washed my hands until they bled. I also had harm-related thoughts, so I was very concerned that, I guess, one day I was thinking to myself with regards to my little brother, like, oh, my God, I'm just going to kill you, because I was very frustrated with him. And then I hooked on to that, and I was very, very concerned for a very long time that I was going to hurt him, and I avoided the kitchen. I thought that any step towards the direction of the kitchen might indicate that I was going for a knife or something.
Oh, the kitchen as the repository of knives.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so at what point were you diagnosed with OCD?
I actually, unlike many people with OCD, I was actually diagnosed very early on. As soon as I told my mom what was going on, I was actually at a therapist the next day who diagnosed me with OCD.
And John, what is your personal history with OCD?
So I don't talk too much publicly about my personal history with OCD, in part because I kind of like hanging on to one little piece of it that's just mine and like just for my therapist. There's something kind of empowering about that.
Okay. So tell me about how one treats OCD.
Well, I'll start with the first thing everybody really needs to know, which is the gold standard treatment for OCD is called cognitive behavioral therapy, with an emphasis on something known as exposure and response prevention.
What is that?
So exposure and response prevention is where you work with someone with OCD and collaborate with them on strategies to confront the thing that they're afraid of, the thing that they're uncertain about, and you gradually introduce them to the thing that's upsetting them and dysregulating them. And then that's the exposure. And then the response prevention is resisting the compulsions. So you're retraining the brain that it can be in that state of uncertainty and that state of distress without having to do the compulsive behavior.
Hannah, tell me more about what is going on in the brain with OCD.
In the brain of somebody with OCD, there's an inhibited response of essentially putting on the brake of doing repetitive behaviors. So in people without OCD, there might be naturally this inhibitory response where it's like, okay, you don't need to do that again. That sort of checkbox, that feeling of being done and I'm all good, I can put this over here now, that is not something that comes naturally to people with OCD, at least in relation to what their obsessions are. So it feels constantly unfinished or unchecked, or it never will feel quite right. And then, of course, you also have, you know, the anxiety response that, you know, the fight or flight response that, that you know, you might experience if you were in some sort of life-threatening situation. Of course, OCD can also sort of run on disgust as well. The cycle doesn't have to be perpetuated with anxiety.
Is that why medications are sometimes used in treatment?
Sure, and they have varying effects. For some people, it works very well. It's a life changer. For other people, it takes a little bit of the edge off. And for other people, it's just not, it doesn't work that well. What I think is a lot of times a missing piece is coupling the medication with exposure and response prevention, because the medication likely will only do so much. It's not going to, you know, even though it might, you know, give you sort of a new lease on life, it's not going to completely change everything. And it's easy to fall back into those behaviors.
I think the important thing to understand about medication is that even when it works in the best possible way, it's still working by facilitating your ability to choose different behaviors in the face of your obsessions. And it's that change in behavior that's actually causing changes in the brain. So that's why cognitive behavioral therapy is the thing you need to be thinking about first. And then if your person is going to benefit from medication as well, then that will be something that adds to that. You know, they're both on the same side, which is trying to help you get better. It's not a one or the other kind of thing.
A lot to think about. We need to take a short break here. We're talking about obsessive compulsive disorder with two therapists who know what it's like to struggle with it, Hannah Breckenridge and John Hirschfeld. When we're back from a quick break, we'll hear from a researcher about OCD among African Americans, and I'll ask about the stigma of OCD. I'm Sheila Cass. Stick with us on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. You probably know someone with obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, even if you don't know you do. The International OCD Foundation says about 1 out of 100 adults and 1 out of 200 children and teenagers live with the disorder. We're talking this morning with two therapists who have dealt with OCD themselves and have built their careers around treating the disorder. John Hirschfeld is a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist who directs the OCD and Anxiety Center of Greater Baltimore. He's written several books, including When a Family Member Has OCD and Overcoming Harm OCD. And Hannah Breckenridge is a social worker and therapist in Lutherville who specializes in treating people with obsessive-compulsive spectrum disorders as well as generalized anxiety disorders. OCD seems to affect men, women, and children of all ethnicities and backgrounds, although there's not been much research on that. Dr. Monica Williams of the Department of Psychological Sciences at the University of Connecticut has looked into it. On the phone, I asked her what we know about the incidence of OCD among African Americans.
Well, actually, it's as common among African Americans as it is in the general population. And this actually wasn't even known until about 10 years ago when the first research studies that surveyed the whole population of the country really looked at this in depth. Because African Americans weren't coming in for treatment, so nobody even knew if they had OCD.
African Americans were not coming in for treatment, and then that's something you also looked into. Why is that?
There's a lot of reasons. For one, the symptoms can be very stigmatizing, and a lot of African Americans already feel stigmatized. So to go to a mental health professional and say, hey, I can't control my thoughts, particularly if you have to go outside of your community, that's really hard. And there are very, very few black psychologists, period, much less who have special experience in OCD. So if you're African-American and you're looking for someone who's African-American who knows how to treat this, it's going to be really hard to find that person.
And you've also looked at the incidence of OCD among African-American children, correct?
So this is a little bit sketchy because there's actually been no research, not a single research study focused on African-American children with OCD. And I actually applied for grant funds from the National Institute of Health to study this, and it wasn't a funding priority. So what we do know is all sort of theoretical and gleaned from little pieces of other studies, and it appears that African-American children do suffer just as much as everyone else, but in terms of the details as to why they're not being served and how it looks in them and how to help them, we just don't know.
So this is all kind of a worrisome picture. What do you think should be done next?
I think it needs to be a funding priority to better understand OCD in youth of color broadly, not even just African Americans. I couldn't find one study on any ethnic minority group and children with OCD. So this needs to be something we pay a lot more attention to, that we decide is important for the mental health of our whole country, so we can help those suffering kids.
That was Monica Williams from the University of Connecticut Department of Psychological Sciences. What strikes you about her points?
I mean, she is absolutely right. There are very few people who specialize in treating OCD, period. And so finding some, you know, somebody that you feel comfortable with that's from your ethnic group or, you know, from where you grew up is going to be nearly impossible, I have to say, you know, based off of, you know, what I've seen.
On the issue of who has OCD, it just strikes me as abundantly obvious that, you know, if the problem is kind of an issue with the good enough mechanism of the brain malfunctioning, you know, things don't feel good enough, locks aren't close enough, stoves aren't off enough, I'm not a good enough person is a big thing I see a lot of in my clients. Why would that vary from culture to culture? This is a very human problem. So you would expect to see it everywhere, even if they might not necessarily be able to articulate it as a mental health issue.
I want to pick up on the point about stigma, partly because of the myths that we talked about earlier. I mean, if someone who doesn't know much about OCD thinks it's just a quirk and not really debilitating, well, at least the one aspect of that I would think is doesn't carry much stigma. Or does it? I mean, what's your experience with your clients?
It varies from client to client. I think the forms of OCD that people are more comfortable talking about because they're more familiar with them, because they've seen them portrayed on television, people might be more willing to say, oh, yeah, you know, I'm a compulsive hand washer or I'm a germaphobe. And, you know, they kind of participate in this casual discussion like, oh, it's no big deal. Even if for them it is a very big deal, there's a safety in talking about it like it's not a big deal. But it's a completely different world when we're talking about moral-based obsessions or violent obsessions or sexual obsessions, religious obsessions people have a lot of difficulty talking about. And in some cases, talking about the obsession in the first place might be a compulsion or might be the thing that their OCD says they're not supposed to do because something bad might happen if you talk about it. So it can get messy.
Right. And I would actually say that a lot of the stigma keeps people away from therapy itself because if you're somebody who has thoughts about harming somebody or sexual obsessions, those individuals generally are very worried about even coming in and talking to a therapist about their concerns because they're worried that they might be, you know, misunderstood and, you know, reported to the authorities.
So on the question of finding a therapist, is there any quick advice that you have for people who recognize perhaps in someone they care about or in themselves what we've been talking about?
I guess my big piece of advice would be to find somebody who practices CBT and specifically exposure and response prevention.
It takes a lot of time and energy to become a specialist in OCD. There's a lot of reading and studying and working with people with OCD. So usually what I tell people to look for is when you're going to somebody's website and they say they treat OCD, are they really saying that they treat OCD or is OCD just one thing on a long list of things that they think they can sort of kind of maybe help you with?
We have to wrap this up. What do you most want people to take away from this conversation? People who may not have known about OCD before this.
Well, for the people with OCD who are listening to it and maybe haven't gotten treatment or a little bit scared about reaching out for treatment, one of the things I really love about the work that I do is that it makes sense. It makes sense that if you do CBT and ERP, it should actually help you with your OCD. So I'm never asking, you know, people think, oh, the therapist can ask me to do these weird things and I'm not going to like them and they're going to make me do this, maybe do that. I don't make anybody do anything. I collaborate with them and we both agree that this is a good idea. Then a lot of that stigma kind of vanishes because it's like, oh, I've got this issue and I got kind of stuck in this loop and now I understand how I can get out of the loop and it becomes very practical and a lot less personal. So I like that part of it.
Yeah, and I guess that there is hope and, you know, there is, like John said, there is effective treatment for OCD. I think a lot of us, when we're sort of in the midst of, in the midst of it and feeling very alone and feeling as if this is never going to get better, it can feel very depressing. And so I think knowing that you're not alone and knowing that there is help out there, if you can find it in the right places.
And one more thing for the people who aren't as familiar with OCD, you know somebody right now who is debilitated. You just don't know that you know that about them. You know, you don't know them that well. But somebody in your life, somebody in your circle right now is debilitated by their OCD. They are trudging through from waking up to going to bed at night, trying to figure out a way to survive with these unwanted intrusive thoughts that make them feel terrible about themselves. So, you know, your little joke about pencils not being lined up perfectly, it's just not that funny to them, because it's a real deal, OCD. It's a real mental health challenge. Thankfully, we have treatment for it.
Thank you for this conversation. Very enlightening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Hirschfield is a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist who directs the OCD and Anxiety Center of Greater Baltimore. His books include When a Family Member Has OCD, Everyday Mindfulness for OCD, and the Mindfulness Workbook for OCD. Hannah Breckenridge is a licensed social worker and therapist in Lutherville who specializes in treating people with obsessive compulsive disorder and anxiety. She's former manager for the Therapists with OCD and Related Disorders Special Interest Group. The Mid-Atlantic affiliate of the International OCD Foundation is marking OCD Awareness Week with several events. Friday night in Odenton, you can mix, mingle, and strike out the stigma of OCD at the Greenway Bowl Bowling Alley. Free bowling shoes, pizza, and drinks. We have more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us on the record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.